Sexual assaults happen on America's college campuses more frequently than anyone wants to admit. Today's guest, a victim of sexual assault herself, says it's time to change that reality. She's Sophie Karasik this week on Story in the Public Square. Welcome to A Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. Alongside me is my friend and co-host, G. Wayne Miller of the Providence Journal. Story in the Public Square is an effort to study, celebrate, and tell stories that matter. And we do that each week by talking to journalists, analysts, and occasionally activists to make better sense of the narratives that currently dominate American public life. Joining us this week is Sophie Karasik. A survivor of campus sexual assault, she is the founder of the activist group End Rape on Campus and the national organizer for the In My Words campaign. Sophie, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So, your activism began with your own sexual assault when you were in college. You reported it to your university, but nothing happened. This was about 6 years ago.
This was in 2012.
Yeah. So tell us about the response from the university and you sort of your progress to activism.
Yeah, so when I was a freshman at UC Berkeley in California, I was sexually assaulted by another member of a student organization that I was part of. And I didn't really know what was happening at the time, but what I did know was that I didn't want him to do it again. I didn't want him to be doing this to anybody else. But I found out that he had actually been targeting other young women in the club, and he continued to do it even after he resigned from his position on the board as a result of what he did to me. And we went to the university in order to try and have something done about it so that we could truly intervene. And they basically put him on disciplinary probation. So that means that if he were to do it again, then maybe some kind of action would be taken from the university. And they didn't actually do a real investigation, and they let him graduate early, and they, you know, just had this process that was really, really difficult for me to be a part of because they didn't want to actually communicate with us.
So we hear this is unfortunately not a unique story.
No.
In terms of universities not wanting to really investigate or get to the bottom of these things. Why is there such reticence, institutional reticence, to get to the truth and to hold people accountable?
I think it's actually something that's not just campuses, but you also see it in other institutions. Like, a lot of people have been talking about it in the context of Me Too with, like, workplaces, or before campuses, we were talking about it in the military or in faith-based institutions. And there are just these really entrenched conflicts of interest that exist within institutional spaces of not wanting to have somebody who has a lot of power or recognition or status be brought down by something that is inconvenient. So that there's both that dynamic of not wanting to have powerful people be held to account, but then also at the same time you have them protecting their bottom line. So with institutions like universities, they're protecting a brand, so they don't want to seem like an unsafe place to send your kid to school. So they would much rather pretend like nothing is happening. And you have the same situation at a lot of other institutions as well, where it's a lot easier for people to try and say, oh, no, this doesn't happen here.
This doesn't happen on our campus.
Yeah.
So you could have had any number of valid reactions to your experience. You took what happened to you and you co-founded the End Rape on Campus campaign. And you were 19, is that correct?
Yeah.
What motivated you to do that? I mean, that took a certain degree of courage, I would think, particularly given the institutional reaction and the times.
Yeah, I think that the way that I felt that my Like every person who experiences sexual harm has a different reaction or has their own way of healing from what happened to them. And for me, I felt that it was such a severe injustice that had been done to us by the university that I just felt really motivated to do something differently because I was talking to all of these other students who were having similar experiences. And so it was largely feeling like my way of healing was to do something about it. That for some people, their way of healing can be like being in therapy, or their way of healing cannot be to talk about it or to like talk just with friends and whatever that looks like for them. But for me, it was my activism was my way of healing from what happened. That was what gave me a real fire to be able to do something that was different.
So how did you build that movement? Obviously others joined in. I mean, was this, this was a grassroots effort, I'm assuming?
Yeah, so basically how it came about was that I was talking to other students at UC Berkeley about what was going on in their situations. And I saw this article in the New York Times right around when we were trying to pass a bill through our student government at UC Berkeley, a bill of no confidence in how our university was handling these cases. Right around that time, I saw this article in the New York Times about how students were connecting across the country to hold their institutions accountable for mishandling cases. So I reached out to the people in that article and I said, like, hey, this exact same thing is happening here in Berkeley. And so we connected over Facebook and like started talking through like Skype and were able to talk about how we could file a Title IX complaint against Berkeley for sweeping these cases under the rug, and also to file a complaint jointly with survivors from other schools who had had similar experiences so that we could show it was a national problem.
And this was before the Me Too movement, as we know it today. It was before the New Yorker and New York Times reported on Harvey Weinstein. It was before the current era. So in a sense, it sort of set the plate for what later came.
Yeah, so I think that it shifted the way that the public was thinking about sexual assault to be from thinking that sexual assault is something that is very rare to realizing that this happens at an epidemic level on college campuses. And it really primed the public to think about what is happening more generally now. It's like we were able to show the failure of yet another institution in dealing with these problems.
So so the current Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos, has changed the interpretation of Title IX and has de-emphasized holding people who are guilty of sexual assault to account. How does this, so I mean, this is a big swing of the pendulum that's being directed by Washington. Given all the work that you've done, is that a source of, it has to be a source of great frustration.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's crazy because we're simultaneously in this environment where people are talking about sexual violence in a way that hasn't happened in this country before. So you have this huge national conversation about sexual violence and harassment, but meanwhile, students, and it's not just colleges, but also K through 12 schools, are just being completely ignored in the national conversation. So sexual assault that's happening in schools or in educational settings more broadly, it's just not something that's being discussed. And so it's very frustrating to feel like they're not being heard, and also that Betsy DeVos is systemically like targeting survivors at the same time as this national issue is happening. So it's, yeah, it's quite frustrating.
So a little bit earlier this year, you had a really powerful op-ed piece in the New York Times, and the theme of it was punitive justice and how survivors and activists, many, have become disillusioned with punitive justice as a response to these acts. Tell us first what punitive justice is.
Yeah, so punitive justice is this idea that the way that we enforce moral behavior as a society is through enacting punishment. And so that's basically the setup that we have for our criminal system more generally. And you also see it play out in our politics where, for instance, Republicans say that the way that we should make poor people be able to like do better for themselves is by cutting food stamps or cutting Medicaid or whatever it is. We have to punish them.
You do something wrong, you have to be punished.
Yeah, right. And that will get you to behave better or whatever. And so that's just a fundamental part of American society, is that if we punish people, then they will behave in the way that we want them to behave. And in the context of sexual violence, it's, oh, so we really don't want people to be committing sexual harassment and sexual assault, so what we're going to do is fire them or incarcerate them or expel them, and that is supposed to teach them the lesson that they won't do it again. But the reality is that that's often not actually meeting what the survivor would have wanted in the situation, and also does a poor job of changing the behavior. But so punitive justice is a focus on punishment as the way of being able to get retribution.
So if not punitive justice, what?
Yeah, so I think some alternative forms of justice are out there and have been practiced in many communities, both in the United States and around the world, for many years. So for instance, there's restorative justice and transformational justice. So basically being able to actually view the humanity of everyone in this situation and being able to come from a place of empathy and connection and being able to say, like, hurt people hurt people, and being able to see, like, okay, what is it that can be done to repair the harm that was caused to the survivor in this situation? So, for instance, is it an acknowledgement that there was harm done, and to be able to feel seen and heard by the person who, like, did that to you? Is that, like, what that person needs? Or perhaps they're also looking for support from other community members. So, for instance, maybe what hurt them the most, or what they are really grappling with, is that, for instance, maybe their uncle sexually assaulted them, but their mother never supported them and didn't believe them. So being able to have the support from the mom is actually really important in that situation, for instance. So there are lots of different ways in which this this like level of betrayal can happen from sexual violence that isn't remedied by the traditional system.
We're going to pause now for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. You can hear this program four times every weekend on the Sirius XM satellite radio channel Politics of the United States. That's the POTUS channel, number 124. We produce Story in the Public Square with a talented professional crew at the studios of Rhode Island PBS, and we're very lucky to work with them. I'm Jim Lutis. In my day job, I run the Pell Center for International Relations and Public Policy at Salve Regina University. If you want to connect with me on Twitter, I'm at JM Lutis. And the co-host chair is my friend, the talented writer, filmmaker, and award-winning journalist with the Providence Journal. G. Wayne Miller is also the author of 17 books. You can find him on Twitter at G. Wayne Miller, all one word. And our guest this week is someone whose voice is heard on one of the most urgent issues of our day. Sophie Karasik is the co-founder of End Rape on Campus, an advocacy organization, and the national organizer for the In My Words campaign. You can find her on Twitter, too, at Sophie, S-O-F-I-E-R, Karasik. That's K-A-R-A-S-E-K.
Is the country ready for that approach to justice? I think about, you know, conversations we've had on this show about just the issue of criminal justice in general. And America's not in a very progressive spot on this. It's like, ma'am, you do something wrong, you need to be punished.
And
that punishment typically is the deprival of some right, typically the right of free movement, right? That's incarceration is the way we like to punish people in this country. That's not how we punish people for campus assault. And so is the kind of justice that you're talking about, is America ready for that, I guess, is what I'm asking.
Well, I think that what is interesting is that for many years we've had this lens of punitive justice that's supposedly in the name of victims of crime,
right,
or it's supposedly in the name of protecting our broader society. But actually, if you actually ask people who have been affected by crime, what is it that you want? a lot of the time people haven't even been asked, first of all. But second of all, it's like people are looking for something that's much more tied to their like innate sense of humanity and being able to have a sense of accountability from the other person or from the community more broadly. And our systems that exist aren't actually set up to provide that. So you have these systems that are supposedly supposed to stop the violence from happening, but we have terrible rates of recidivism. And you're not actually learning in these kinds of carceral contexts how to actually be behaving in a way that's respectful of other people and to be thinking about what does love or healthy relationship look like that's different from violence or coercion. And those kinds of things aren't actually being taught. And so it's not actually a real intervention. And they're also not feeling they're not being confronted with the shame or the guilt of having hurt somebody close to them, since usually it is somebody that you know.
So how would this approach be implemented on a practical level? Would this be through the court systems, through departments of corrections, universities in the case of that institutional setting and so forth? How practically would that happen?
Yeah, I think that, to be honest, the relationship between the courts and the movement against sexual violence has in large part been responsible for the way in which there is such a limited, there are such limited options between, like, you can either report someone to the police or you can do nothing. That's largely because we've set it up as that's what you're supposed to do. So people have always really emphasized reporting as, like, we need to increase the rates of reporting. And so that's something that's pretty deeply ingrained. And so I think that actually trying to look at this as an issue that is separate from the court system would be a really interesting approach that people could be thinking about. So, for instance, having an independent agency that is not actually tied to the Department of Justice, but is able to actually provide the resources that survivor needs. So, like, if there were, like, a Survivor's Justice Bureau that had all of the different ways that people were looking for some kind of truth and reconciliation in this situation. So being able to actually have access to free mental health care, but also being able to have access to facilitators for whichever kind of restorative or transformative justice process it would be that you were looking for.
You know, so a lot of this conversation has so far, today has concentrated on what happens after an assault takes place. What about preventing those incidences in the first place? I think, just young men and young women who don't know what they're doing in interpersonal relationships. Is that part of it? How do we educate people about what's right and what's wrong? I don't know how else to ask that question.
Yeah, I mean,
I think that's perfectly that is the question. That's well put.
I mean, I wish that was something that was actually more emphasized in schools than it is. You know, we teach students these like very like concrete subjects of like social studies and math and science, but there's not really a focus on how do you actually address conflict in a way that's nonviolent. How do you actually be able to articulate the feelings that you have when you're hurt by someone or something, and to be able to do that in a way that is actually able to get your needs met and you're able to, like, continue to be friends with that person? Like, that's not something that we talk about in schools broadly, even though that would be something that would be really useful for people to know. So I think that with regards to prevention, there are a lot of skills with regards to like being able to actually express how you feel and to be able to listen as well to how other people feel that should be taught in educational settings much earlier that aren't necessarily. So that's one thing. But then also like being able to intervene in sexual violence situations is also a way of prevention. I don't think that anyone or I think that the majority of people aren't a lost cause to, like, if they've sexually harassed or sexually assaulted someone, I think that those people, they can have interventions that can stop them from doing it again.
Future.
Yeah.
So once again, it comes down to education in many regards. You know, the educational system is something we talk about frequently on this program with a number of different topics. You use, in describing your philosophy and approach, four very powerful words: reimagining justice and healing. Love those words. We've talked some about the justice part. Talk some about the healing part, and tell us, is that for survivors, or is that also for perpetrators, or for both?
Yeah, I definitely think that healing is for everyone, and I think that something that also gets lost when we have these binaries of, like, survivors and perpetrators is not realizing that, like, oftentimes perpetrators are also survivors, and they're just, like, lots of different, it can just be very difficult to put people into these boxes. So I think that healing fundamentally is about being able to look at our collective humanity and to say, like, okay, there are no bad people. There are no good people. There's good behavior and there's bad behavior. And, like, this is something that can, I hope, make people feel like there's more, that they can actually have faith in humanity at a time that's, like, you know, there's
when our faith is being tested,
yeah,
let's put it that way.
Yeah, a lot of bad things are happening,
yeah,
you know, and
yeah.
So I found it to be really helpful for me to feel like, oh, maybe there actually is some hope in the world when people can actually have their behaviors changed, that being able to see people as being fundamentally capable of change is in many ways liberating as well.
Well, I happen to agree. I think most people can change with the proper intervention and healing and techniques and methods. I think it's a great philosophy, though, and it's very refreshing in today's, you know, sort of black and white discussion.
Yeah.
I'm curious, to put this sort of conversation in sort of the broader national context right now. So we have, the governor of Missouri is facing impeachment proceedings based on his alleged sexual assault. The attorney general of New York just recently resigned. The question I want to ask is how do these incidences contribute to the work that you've done to raise awareness, to try to reform the way institutions respond to these types of incidences? In one case, you get the Attorney General of New York, who resigns within hours of it becoming public.
By the New Yorker piece, we would note.
But the governor of Missouri, he's fighting it. Right? And so how does all of this contribute to the work that you've tried to do to raise awareness and change the way institutions behave in these kinds of scenarios?
Yeah, so I think that with public office, you have this unique situation where public officials are actually representing people, and they're representing women as well. So when you have people that are saying, you know, if I beat women, it's not related to my job as a public official, or if I did this, you know, it was in my personal life and it's not in any way related to my job as an elected official or whatever, that actually that is just such a bizarre way of understanding.
It insults our intelligence too, right?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. It's just like a bizarre way of understanding what your job is as a public official. Like, you are representing people that are living in a country where there are very high rates of domestic violence and sexual violence, and so you're representing survivors. And so for you to then be somebody who's perpetuating violence in your own life, it shows that you don't actually value the humanity of women.
Right.
So that's what really gets to me, is seeing people who are supposed to be behaving with, you know, decent character and, like, actually respecting the humanity of people acting like
that. That's really what the core of this, isn't it? It's just sort of the losing sight of the humanity of the other person.
Right.
Right?
Right.
It speaks to the morality of some of these people as well, too, their moral compass or lack thereof. before we are at the end of our program, which is coming soon, you are hard at work on the In My Words movement. You're building that. Tell us about that. Where you are? Are you going to have a formal launch? How's it going?
Yeah, it's going really well. So basically, we're a small team of organizers, mostly based on the East Coast, who have been veterans of various other movements, who are really thinking about what strategies for nonviolent civil resistance have worked in movements, not just in the U.S., but around the world.
Movements of all kinds.
Movements of all kinds, mm-hmm. Yeah. And thinking about how do we create a social movement that can move us in the direction of these alternative justice forms. So as you asked about, is the public ready for this? You know, that's a question that we're thinking about. How do you actually build public support for something that's pretty different from what we have now? So we just had our second retreat. We're having these retreats every 6 weeks, and we just had our second one last weekend, so people can follow along. So
and you have a website, and tell us about the website or give us the address
quickly. Yeah, it's inmywordsmovement.org.
And so it's a broad-scale criminal justice reform movement, is that?
It's
or
related
specifically
to sexual assault and sexual violence and domestic violence.
So, you know, one of the flip things that I saw people saying on Twitter last night, maybe flip's not the right way to categorize, but one of the quick things that I saw, hot takes on Twitter, when the New York Attorney General resigned, was that this is the solution to this is to elect more women. Is that do you think that's part of the dynamic here about?
Well, I mean, I certainly think that is part of it, that we do need more women in office. And I think that just stems from many things, but also that we should have representation that's proportional to the way that our country
looks.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's, you know, a big part of it.
We need to leave it there. Sophie Karasik. She's with End Rape on Campus and the In My Words campaign. That's all the time we have this week, but if you want to know more about Story in the Public Square, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or you can always catch us on PellCenter.org, where you can also catch up on previous episodes. For G. Wayne Miller, I'm Jim Lutis, asking you to join us again next time for more Story in the Public Square.